This episode of Arizona Spotlight is supported by De Gracia Gallery and the Sun Museum.
For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up. After taking last year off during the pandemic, the Tucson celebration of Juneteenth returns with some renewed energy. A conversation between artist Alejandro Macias and curator Christopher Driggers, part of the current Tucson Museum of Art exhibition called 4x4. And meet Jillian Cowles, a clinical microbiologist and naturalist, who chooses to spend a lot of time in a secret world where few others dare. The private lives of spiders and scorpions. Those stories are next on Arizona Spotlight. In a world without COVID-19, last June would have featured the 50th official Tucson gathering and recognition of Juneteenth. This year, the celebration will be receiving more attention than usual, as the United States Senate just this week passed legislation making Juneteenth a national holiday. It commemorates the day in 1865, 2 years after Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, when the last U.S. slaves in Galveston, Texas, received news of their freedom. Valerie Stanley is the president of the Tucson Juneteenth Festival Board, and I wanted to find out in what ways this year's event might be different.
Well, we start planning in October of the previous year, and so October of last year, we had no idea where the city was going to be in terms of people getting out and restrictions. So we voted to just go ahead and do a virtual event. So we will be doing a virtual event on Saturday from 11 to 1, which will be aired on the Pima Community College TV channel on YouTube. Months later, February, March, things started looking better and better as far as people getting out. We have always had vendors and food trucks at our festival, and we know that everybody is suffering through this pandemic, especially the small businesses. So we're going to do Saturday from 4 to 8 at the Dunbar, a live event to honor our food trucks and vendors.
Valerie, are you doing a limited presentation this year? In other words, it's going to be the food trucks and there won't be other things happening, or what do you have planned?
Well, we're going to have a DJ, and we'll have informational retail and food vendors there. But our main focus is going to be at our virtual event in the morning from 11 to 1.
And what kind of speakers will you be featuring?
Well, we have some pastors actually giving the opening prayer and the benediction, and then we have several pastors who will give reflections on Juneteenth. We have entertainment, so we will have Jackie Blue, who's been in Tucson forever, and he is a kind of R&B, kind of bluesy kind of guy, giving us his song on Juneteenth. We have Dancing in the Streets, Joey Rogers and his wife, Celeste, have a performance. I believe his daughter is an opera singer, so she's going to be singing and having his students dance to her opera singing. So that's going to be really interesting. We also have reflections from people who grew up here in Tucson and remember Juneteenth from years ago. So we'll have people speaking about their remembrances, their memories of Juneteenth from 20, 30, 50 years ago. It's only 2 hours, so we tried to cram as much as we possibly could into 2 hours.
And then after people enjoy the virtual event from home, then they can go down to the food trucks and visit.
Yes. Yeah. And that will be from 4 o'clock, so they give a little lull there from 1 to 4. And then at 4 o'clock, we'll start our live in-person event, which we're really excited about.
The community really needs it.
Yes. Yes, we do. And like I said, we also need to patronize the small businesses. So we're excited to be doing that. I believe that Juneteenth has always been a way for Blacks in Tucson to be able to showcase who we are through the arts, through our businesses. I always believe that Juneteenth was the pathway. Every time we had the festival, I would see people of other races come to Juneteenth and really get into trying to understand the Buffalo Soldiers and what they went through, why Juneteenth is so important to Blacks. And I think that we are able to come together and just reminisce sadly and gladly about where we are, where we came from, who we are as a people. I really hope all the time that Juneteenth starts a conversation with people. Like, I was taking a walk this morning in my neighborhood, and I live in a predominantly white neighborhood. Most Black people do in Tucson. And I had my Juneteenth t-shirt on, and two white women walked past me and they said, "Oh, Juneteenth is coming soon." I said, "Yes, on Saturday." And they said, "Well, happy Juneteenth." And that is the expression that we want to hear from people, that you acknowledge, just acknowledge the existence of what happened in our past. We need for people to understand that our history can't be forgotten. And Juneteenth is one way to continue to talk about our history.
And to, in my experience, always graciously welcome new people to the conversation.
Absolutely. And I think that's what needs to happen in this country. The people need to stop being afraid to have the conversation, because it happened. It needs to be in our history books. And we need to know that people see and hear and feel what we as a race went through. It can't be swept under the carpet anymore and not talked about anymore. But we want people to be comfortable to have that conversation, because we as a race are suffering. We continue to suffer through the disparities of everything going on in this country. If you know history, you will understand why we suffer as a people. And that's all we want people to understand.
At Valerie Stanley's suggestion, I then reached out to Joseph Rogers, the co-founder of Dancing in the Streets, a nonprofit that welcomes dancers of all ages and levels of ability. Dancing in the Streets will be among the featured performers during the Juneteenth virtual presentation on Saturday between 11 and 1 p.m., and Rogers has a story to tell about this year's inspiration.
Okay, well, the story is, when I called Valerie, or she called me, she said she wanted some kind of dance or something kind of different, you know. Matter of fact, I said I have a niece who is a professional opera singer, and I would love to bring her down here, and she can sing, and kids can dance around her. And she thought that was a great idea. So we're putting it together. As I was putting it together, I was talking to a friend of mine. He owns a radio station called Curb Radio. It's an internet radio. And I told him about the idea that I was doing, and then he went and asked me the question, and my wife was there. He's going, "Wow, Joey, this might be the first African-American woman opera singer who's going to sing at Dunbar. She might be the first one." And during this time when we were talking, my wife was doing some research, and it came to be that she's not. There was an opera singer back in 1941, and her name was Marian Anderson. She was the first African-American opera singer back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And it came to be in 1941, U of A brought her out here to Tucson for a concert, and she wanted to do an outreach. At that time, Dunbar didn't have an auditorium. It's just a school. So what she did was she went in front of the principal's office in the hallway and just started singing. And all the kids, all the teachers were like going, What is that sound?
They have never heard anything like that.
It was almost like the Shawshank Redemption when that guy puts on the opera music. The teachers went out. The teacher says, "Come on, kids, let's go see what this woman's doing." They went out and she sang them an aria right then and there. And the kids and the teachers didn't know what was going on. So this is just kind of the story that we're kind of bringing back, opera singing. So we're trying to educate the African-Americans that there were opera singers, there were Black composers back in the heyday. So I guess that's what the story that we're trying to get at.
Thanks to Valerie Stanley, president of the Tucson Juneteenth Board of Directors, and Joseph Rogers, co-founder of the all-ages nonprofit Dancing in the Streets. The virtual Juneteenth celebration is happening Saturday, June 19th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's followed by a special Black Renaissance Arts event that's airing that evening at 9. These will all be accessible for free on the Pima Community College TV stream on YouTube. In real life, a host of local vendors and food trucks will be gathered at the Dunbar Pavilion between 4 and 8 p.m. The pavilion is at the corner of North Main and West 2nd Street. A current exhibition at the Tucson Museum of Art is taking an inclusive approach, asking 4 curators to each choose a contemporary artist they admire, and then present those 4 solo shows together as one. 4x4 removes the idea that there is one dominant narrative about life. It reminds us that the range of lived experience is varied and nuanced. Throughout the month of June on this show, you'll be hearing conversations between the 4 curators and artists.
I heard from my mother, "Tienes una palma frente," which translates to "you have a cactus on your forehead," as a way to kind of, my mom was critical of that, like, you're trying to Americanize yourself and you're obviously assimilating, but you're kind of forgetting where you came from. My name is Alejandro Macias. I'm an artist, originally from Texas, now based down in Tucson, Arizona. And I'm also an assistant professor at the University of Arizona School of Art.
My name is Christopher Driggers. I'm an art historian, and I'm the Schmidt Curator of Latin American Art at the Tucson Museum of Art. I actually first met Alex around 3 years ago. We were both living in Texas's Rio Grande Valley, and we were both on the faculty at a university there.
I moved here literally a year after Christopher arrived, and I knew that he had a job as a curator somewhere, but I couldn't remember that it was exactly at the Tucson Museum of Art.
Then when we had this idea of doing this show of 4 Tucson artists, I thought this was just kind of a perfect moment to highlight someone who had a lot to say about living in the borderlands.
Everything just fell into place, and I was really excited to participate in basically my Tucson debut.
When you come into Alex's part of the 4x4 exhibition, you see a lot of different portraits, all brightly colored, and a lot of them have different kind of visual puns. So sometimes there will be serape decorations over some of their bodies, sometimes there will be cactuses covering the foreheads, and sometimes we'll see different kind of meditations on landscapes and figures coming to and leaving different spaces.
In terms of the execution, a lot of it is representational of the figure, and so it ties to identity. And then you have this kind of abstract execution, which is, again, a metaphor for the assimilation process. Across a lot of the works, you'll see this like literal division, and the division itself acts as a metaphor for the division between South Texas and Mexico. At the same time, I'm critical of assimilation and the process of it, and it almost seems like an erasure of history and culture and this very traditional Mexican background. But at the same time, I'm also celebrating both sides. The work definitely responds to that and that inner struggle that I definitely have and many other people do.
One of my favorite works is a bisected panel cut in half where we see Alex's art teacher, Carlos Gomez, surrounded by really lush foliage. The panel is split with the same shape as the border of Texas, the same shape as the Rio Grande separating Texas and Mexico. And it's a really interesting work because you can actually see that split really viscerally.
There's literally a split between the works, and I'm also really interested in my former professor's work in terms of the way he approached work and Chicano art and how he used his color palette and his color palette to celebrate his own bicultural experience. And so it's mostly kind of like I feel like a passing of the torch. I can't help but be inspired by him. And the palette is evident in the work, right?
Alex and I kind of come from the same place. My mom is Mexican. I grew up speaking some Spanish. So the phrases that we see here, the kind of ideas, I felt like I could, they're yours, but I felt like I could follow you and see where you were going. And for me, that made this particular project really special.
Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, it was really neat to work with someone who I feel like I just kind of got.
we come from similar backgrounds, you know, and even like light-skinned Latinos. And I think even responding to who identifies as Latino and specifically Mexican-American.
Alex came in with a lot of really strong ideas from the get-go, and I sort of followed his lead.
Yeah, I just want to add, it was definitely a collaborative effort, and he was straightforward with me, which I loved.
One of the things that's sort of special about living in the borderlands, especially kind of thinking about culture, is that there are a lot of people who are thinking about what is my place here? How do I fit into this region? That's a region where there are a lot of different influences coming in and moving out. It's one of the things that I really love about Tucson and that, like Alex was saying, also we sort of share with South Texas. It's this place where people are coming up with answers to this question. And I think that for me, it's really important that we see that visual artists, painters, sculptors can really lead the way in this conversation, helping us to figure out who are we and what are we doing here and how do we relate to this place? How do we fit in this place where we live?
Artist Alejandro Macias talking with TMA curator Christopher Driggers, and a story produced by Andrew Brown. You can see a video version of the story now on the Arizona Illustrated Facebook and Instagram pages. 4x4 will be on view at the Tucson Museum of Art through September 26th. Next week, hear about the inspiration behind the multimedia art of An Tai Nguyen, who maps out the hauntingly beautiful landscape of emotions. Jillian Cowles grew up with a passion for biology. She was the daughter of horticulturalist parents who supported her interest in science. After years doing research in windowless laboratory basements, she yearned to spend time in nature, using her skills with photography and some of her boundless patience to record the tiny, hidden world of arachnids, including spiders and scorpions. Cowles has since made many important discoveries about arachnid behavior and captured events that previously had never been seen by human eyes. Her 2018 book, Amazing Arachnids, includes more than 750 of her photos to illustrate the research. Recently, her interest in understanding the life cycle of kleptoparasitic spiders, these are tiny nest invaders that usually stay out of the way of the larger spider until it's time to make a precision egg sac heist. Well, this has led her to document some previously unseen activity, and it all happened surprisingly close to her Sonoran Desert home.
About half of it was done in setups where I tried to simulate natural conditions but could see what was going on. For example, terrariums with cutaway burrows so that I could see what vinegaroons were doing underground. And about half of it was done right out in the field just observing. The work on kleptoparasitic spiders is all done in natural settings. I would call it natural in the sense that the animals established themselves in their settings, but some of that happened to be on my front porch or in my yard.
How is it that kleptoparasitic spiders became a part of the arachnid universe?
Oh, that's a very good question. There's been a lot of phylogenetic work to see where they lie in terms of their evolutionary relationship to other spiders, trying to tease out how kleptoparasitism evolved. So the kleptoparasitic spiders are fairly closely related to social spiders. And in fact, they show some interesting social tendencies, such as group living in a web. Several adult kleptoparasitic spiders will share living space in the host web. And they tolerate each other, and sometimes they even help each other to steal food from the host. The vast majority of spiders are solitary, but a few spiders have independently evolved social behavior. And this social behavior can run through a continuum of behaviors that range from simple maternal care of young to actual multi-generational sharing of a web, sharing food, cooperative killing of prey, and sharing duties for raising young.
In relation to black widow spiders, the kleptoparasitic spider that lives in their webs with them, what are we going to call that spider?
That's Argyrodes pluto. These little kleptoparasitic spiders are only about 4 millimeters in body length at full maturity. So they're a lot smaller than the host spider, which is the adult female black widow, who is far more formidable.
So when you're as small as the Argyrodes that you just described, the world is an even bigger place. It's absolutely ginormous to even go from one end of a room to another. So how in the world do these tiny kleptoparasitic spiders find black widows to cohabitate with?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't think anyone really knows the answer, because to be able to follow a baby Argyrodes Pluto that has just dispersed from its home web and it's out looking for a new black widow web to live in, it would be really hard to observe that little spider's activity. It's not like you can put some kind of a little radio device on it. It's a tiny little animal, and basically you lose track of it almost as soon as it leaves the host web. So how do they find it, the black widow web? They probably balloon, and eventually a small percentage of them probably home in on suitable shelters that might also harbor a black widow host.
That's amazing, though, just to consider it. As few and far between as black widows are at our scale, at their scale, it's just that part has already blown my mind.
It is pretty amazing when you think about it. How do they find something like that? And there's probably pheromones in the silk of the black widow that they recognize immediately if they encounter it. But the trouble is, how did they encounter it in the first place? They must be attracted to the same kinds of draws that a black widow would be looking for to set up home. The black widow is not only much larger, but she is fiercely devoted and very protective of her precious egg sac. And as a consequence, she hides the egg sac in her silk tunnel retreat, and she guards it in there. And the only time that she leaves is when she's out wrapping prey in her web. And that's when the little Argyrodes spring into action, and they nip up into her silk retreat and cut down her egg sac and carry it out. And they have to do it very rapidly, because even while she's wrapping prey, the black widow occasionally stops and runs back to her silk retreat. And she goes up in there, and I believe that she's checking on her egg sac when she pauses during prey wrapping. If they don't get a black widow egg sac right away, they can feed on gleaned insects that the black widow ignores. For example, small moths or possibly an ant or something like that that gets tangled in the black widow web. But in all the time that I was watching these little Argyrodes Pluto, I only saw them feeding on insect prey twice. In fact, any time that they managed to steal a black widow egg sac, after about 10 days of feeding from it, an adult female Argyrodes Pluto almost invariably would produce an egg sac of her own. So it seems like the production of their own egg sacs was almost contingent upon the ability to feed on a black widow egg sac over a period of several days. Now, the only Argyrodes I saw actually stealing black widow egg sacs were female Argyrodes. They're the ones that are the active little thieves.
You talked about the instincts of the black widow to protect their egg sacs, but what about the Argyrodes Pluto? Are they protective of theirs?
Oh, yes. The Argyrodes Pluto has an egg sac that she builds out in a portion of the black widow web. She doesn't have a shelter the way that the black widow has, a little tubular shelter.
And the black widow tolerates this? Isn't interested
yes,
in the eggs as a food source?
Yes, the black widow tolerates them, these little Argyrodes living in her web. And they seem to know where the black widow travels frequently and where she rarely travels. So they build their little egg sac in a spot that the black widow rarely goes. Argyrodes Pluto, when she builds her egg sac out in such an exposed area, of course, that's susceptible to parasitoids and predators, and she actively defends her egg sac. So this wasp egg parasitoid is called Arachnopteromalus dazes. And I watched one of these little wasps attempt to land on the Argyrodes Pluto egg sac. For over 40 minutes, the mother Argyrodes Pluto frantically tried to sweep away the wasp. It would repeatedly come close, and she'd wave her legs trying to sweep it away. And occasionally when the wasp would land on the egg sac, the spider would chase the wasp around on the outside of the egg sac and would eventually grab it with one leg and then fling the wasp. So this was the first time the active defense of an egg sac had been documented.
And you documented this on your front porch?
Yeah, it was right on my front porch. And so for over 40 minutes, this drama took place. And finally, partly so that I could get an identification made on that wasp, and partly out of pity for this poor little frantic mother spider, I collected the wasp. Eventually, it probably would have succeeded in infiltrating the Argyrodes egg sac because it was a very determined wasp.
That seems like a pretty profound discovery for science. How did it make you feel to document that?
It was fascinating, actually. You know, the thing is about when you witness something that you're probably the first person to have witnessed, it actually gives you this tremendous jolt of exhilaration and energy, because when you discover something new, it just is the best feeling in the world. I mean, honestly, there's nothing better than that. And it's one reason why I think science is so addictive, is because there's so much to discover. And you could be the first person to find or see something. You know, there's lots to be discovered out there.
My guest was clinical microbiologist and macrophotographer Jillian Cowles, the author of Amazing Arachnids, published by Princeton Press. Cowles will be giving a presentation about her discoveries on behalf of the American Arachnology Society on Sunday, June 27th, from 11 to noon. This presentation is free and open to the public. You can find a link for information on the Arizona Spotlight page at azpm.org. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the AZPM radio studios. AZPM's interim news director is Duncan Moon. The music is by Calexico. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. I'm producer and host Mark McLemore.
Thank you to De Grazia Gallery and the Sun Museum for their support of Arizona Public Media.